we're talking about the history of how humans are built and how viruses fit into our genetic picture. We actually have a relationship with viruses that's more complex than you might think. It's one of the many insights about our development as a species in a new book, and we've got the author with us. There's also a line for your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about how viruses and human beings are connected? What questions do you have about human DNA and how much we even know about it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Neil Shubin is a professor and paleontologist at the University of Chicago. His book is called Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. Professor Shubin, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, great to be back here. Good afternoon.
Let's start with those viruses. You wrote in the Wall Street Journal recently that viruses are a part of us, that we're actually full of ancient viruses. How does that work?
Yeah, we've had, you know, we've lived in about 20 years of genome projects where we have the Human Genome Project, the Rice Genome Project, genome projects for thousands of species. And one thing we've learned, particularly about our own DNA, is that our genes, the parts that encode the proteins, the genes inside our genome, are only 2% of it. That is, if you look at the genome, fully 8% of it are ancient viruses that somehow entered our DNA but got knocked out. They're no longer functional. So you can think about our DNA, our genome, as being a graveyard for ancient viruses. It's truly remarkable that they outnumber our own genes 4 to 1.
And how have we figured this out?
Yeah, in the genome projects, when you look at the genome, there's a signature of a particular sequence, a particular structure to viruses. And you can find that by probing the DNA, and you can just see how common it is. But there's another approach that happened that's actually kind of even more astounding in some ways. Researchers at the University of Utah were working on, they weren't virologists, they weren't working on viruses. They were working on a gene that functions during memory. It's called ARC. It's a gene in humans and in mammals that works as we make memories. And they were looking at this gene and looking at the structure of the gene, and they discovered that it looked for all the world like a virus. And indeed, the more they looked and the more they analyzed its structure, the more they came to the conclusion that this gene that functions in our memories to make memories was once a virus that invaded our DNA long ago, eons ago, that the DNA of our distant ancestors, and then was repurposed to be used in memories. I mean, just an incredible, vivid example of, you know, just the role that our relationship with viruses has been over the eons. You know, they can disrupt our world, they can wreck our world, the way we get, you know, the way we interact with each other, but they're also part of our genetic makeup, and sometimes they're put to use.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that you bring that up, because right now, when we're talking about viruses, there's so much attention on this pandemic with COVID-19, and I think we're thinking of viruses as an invader, as something that is a threat, and what you're saying is that's not necessarily the case all the time.
Not all the time. They are invaders, no doubt about it. They are the ultimate parasites. And it's just what they are is little chunks of genetic material surrounded by a shell. And they're just basically programmed to enter a cell and take it over. And take it over with one purpose, to make more copies of themselves. They have different strategies of doing that. But at the end of the result is they can produce each host cell attacked by a virus turns into a factory that can make as many as a million of them before it bursts apart. So think of these things as the ultimate parasite. And that strategy is so enormously successful. By some estimate, there's about 10 to the 31st viruses in the ocean. That's a 10 with 31 zeros after it. That number of viruses in the ocean, an estimate, of course, is larger than the estimate of the number of stars in the known universe. You know, so viruses are amazingly successful. They're not going anywhere. What we have to do is modulate and control our relationship to them. Sometimes it's beneficial. A lot of times it's neutral. And a lot of times it can be very harmful.
Yeah, Neil Shubin is a professor and paleontologist at the University of Chicago, and we are talking about what we know about DNA and our connection to other organisms here. You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can ask a question about viruses in human beings or something about DNA as we focus on that. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. There's a lot in your book, Professor Shubin, that's more than viruses. You write that DNA technology has advanced rapidly in recent years. Help us put that into context. I mean, how much more do we know about DNA now than we used to?
Oh, it's an enormous amount. We know a lot about DNA that is just so surprising. Think about it this way. Each strand of DNA inside our cells is 6 feet long, yet it's wrapped up and folded in on itself to be inside a submicroscopic cell. We have enough DNA in our bodies. If you laid it all end to end and stretched it out, it would go essentially from here, the planet Earth, to Pluto, which is remarkable. And so what we're learning is, what is the DNA that helps build bodies? How does it, you know, how does the DNA act as we develop from a fertilized egg, a single cell, to an adult, which has 4 trillion cells? And what we're learning is how genes are turned on and off during that process to orchestrate the building of our bodies. And the more we look, the more we learn that the toolkit, the DNA-based toolkit that builds our bodies, is also shared with other mammals, with reptiles, with amphibians, with fish, and in some cases, flies and worms. It's truly remarkable. It's revealing our deep connection to the rest of life on our planet.
And yet, is this one of those situations where now that we know more, we're learning how much we actually don't know about DNA and how it functions and its role and how it came about?
Yes, exactly. That's just a wonderful, wonderful question, because that's what science is about. Each time we make a discovery, we open up new questions we didn't even think of before. And in fact, those questions turn out to be like enormous. Like in this case, we have technologies that show us, that can show us each gene in our bodies, and we can see the genes that are active during the building of our bodies. But what we don't know is how those genes act together to actually construct organs and tissues. You know, that's going to take an understanding of a lot of physics and chemistry, you know, as we go, as we study embryological development. But on, you know, 5 to 10 years, we will begin to have those answers.
Shifting gears to evolution, you use the line to the effect of nothing ever happens when you think it's happening. What misconceptions about evolution and timing are you trying to clear up these days?
Well, you know, the more we look at DNA and the more we look at fossils, the more we realize that many of the features that are related to some of the great moments in evolution, like just take one example, lungs and the invasion of land by fish. When fish evolved to walk on land, you know, people associate that with lungs. Feathers and the origin of birds. Well, each of those great inventions came about well before the major revolution they're associated with. That is, lungs came about in fish well before animals took their first steps on land. Feathers came about in dinosaurs well before the first creatures took to flight. And this is true over and over again. What we're seeing is evolution as the ultimate repurposer, as the ultimate tinkerer, as like that person who just never throws anything away and just basically uses the old to build the new. And it's really sort of, these are game-changing observations in many ways, but some of these ideas actually, you know, go back to the Darwinian era.
And let's swing back into viruses. Now, we've got Tom from Port Wing who has a question for us. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is, as the virus increases and it mutates, does it become stronger or weaker as it increases in population and its mutations?
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Yeah. The fact that viruses might degrade or improve, how do we measure that? How do we figure that out?
Yeah, that's true. It can go both ways. Viruses have different abilities to mutate. Some of them actually have inside their little genome, if you can call it that, they have a proofreading system. So some of them actually can correct mistakes, so they don't evolve as fast. Others evolve super fast. And that mutation and that evolution sometimes that we see in the viruses, often that we often see in viruses, can happen both ways. It can take a fairly lethal virus and make it less lethal. It can take a rapidly spreading virus that's not lethal and make it lethal. The biggest, you know, way to control viruses, obviously, is our technologies, including our social technologies, social distancing. We also have technologies that can disrupt the viral life cycle, keep it from reproducing. And obviously, our immune response is another big piece of it, and vaccines are obviously a huge chunk of that.
All right, and we've got Louise from Dodgeville who also has a question. Louise, thanks for being here with us.
Hi. Your guest kind of alluded to it just right now, but I was watching a PBS special on the Spanish flu of 1918. So can your guest just speak to the evolution of viruses a little bit further, and the balance between viruses evolving and our immune system trying to battle them and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Louise. Yeah. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, it's a total arms race. We're at war with viruses. Okay, they are continually invading us, trying to attack our cells, and our immune system is continually trying to ward them off. And what we have inside of our immune system is a library, honestly, of ancient infections. So we, you know, there's a record of the ancient viral infections we had in each of us. That's a byproduct of that war. The problem is our immune system doesn't adapt often quickly enough. That is, a virus can, you know, have its effects on the body before our immune system can fully resolve it. So that's the challenge. That's why we rely on vaccines. That's why I rely on antiviral therapies. And that's why right now, absent both of those, we're relying on social distancing.
There are numerous instances where we've seen scientists be reluctant or defensive when faced with the idea that we can see significant biological change happening rapidly instead of gradually over those eons. You seem okay with that tension. What is most interesting that you find about that idea that sometimes things might be able to move quickly?
Oh, they do move quickly. When we look at, you know, one of the things we realize is that, you know, I'm a paleontologist, and so I'm working on timescales that are millions of years long. But, you know, when we look at timescales of biology, at timescales of embryology and how we go from embryo to adult or viral invasions and so forth, those things happen incredibly fast. So, you know, fast for a paleontologist is something that happens over a million years, which is incredibly slow for somebody thinking about, you know, about DNA changes. You know, but what we're learning is DNA can change very, very, very rapidly.
All right. Professor Shubin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Neil Shubin, professor and paleontologist at the University of Chicago, talking to him today about his new book, Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA.